Okay, do we have? Okay, I think we have everybody back. All right. Okay, so Ms. Robinson, are you still okay? We had a few questions, and then Dr. Bhattoganji, am I pronouncing that anywhere near correct or okay?
Bhatto perfectly. It's Deganji.
Deganji, okay.
It's fine.
Okay, well, no, it's not fine. I'm mispronouncing your name. So, okay.
Everybody
all right.
Know. That's what's
okay, so Ms. Robinson, we had a couple of questions for you, and we may follow up with some more. But under that, who was the client of during your supervision for that time? Oh, Ms. Robinson, I think you're muted.
Thank you. I was a special education teacher in the Litchfield Elementary School District, and developmental preschool children were my clients.
Okay. So the supervision provided was it for your classroom. Is that right? Is that accurate? Okay. So the 1500 hours was for that.
Right.
Okay. Or the 1500 and change was for that. Okay. All right. And then, so the client was essentially your students or the school. Did you do anything besides work with the students, or was it like an OBM type as well, or was it just mainly programming and IEP oversight?
Not IEPs. It was ABA work.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. So the ABA worked. Could you describe that a little bit of what that looked like? The ABA work there.
Data collection, programming, program goals, graphing, training my aides in programs, presentations, PowerPoint presentations.
Mm-hmm.
Various things. I can look back at my field work.
No, it's okay. I wanted to just get kind of a general idea. And then of those, how many were supervised by a licensed behavior analyst, approximately?
1,506 hours.
By a licensed.
Correct.
Okay. So the 1,500 plus was by a licensed behavior analyst.
Right.
Okay. Dr. Bhattoganji is also listed on your BACB verification form. What was the role? What was her role in this then? If the total amount was done by a licensed behavior analyst.
Well, Dr. Bhatto is a licensed behavior analyst, and she's also a faculty member.
Okay. Licensed in the state of Arizona?
No, in the state
okay.
of
Okay. Because there's a requirement that a person is doing supervision, that they have to be licensed in the state in which supervision occurred.
So,
unless that state doesn't have supervision.
Okay. Statute... ARS 32-2091A5, that states that there's an exception for higher learning institutions, such as Arizona State University, where Dr. Bhatto is an instructor or professor.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may, that exception is for the practice and not for licensure, supervision towards licensure. We have a rule, and Ms. Folks, I believe you have the rule handy, that states that in order to be eligible for licensure, you must be supervised by a licensed behavior analyst.
And that rule is R4-26-404.2C4A.
Okay, so let me re-ask that question. So of the 1500 plus hours, was it conducted or supervised by somebody who was a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona?
Yes, and I would say about 130 of those hours were by Nicole Nafisi.
Okay, so 130 of those hours. Okay. Okay, other committee members, any questions at this point? Ms. Robinson, were you going to say something or okay?
Yeah, I'm just looking at both of those codes, and the R4-26-404 does talk about the supervisor qualifications. But then the ARS statute that I mentioned, the 32-2091, says this article does not limit the activity, services, and the use of a title by the following. And it's number 5. So I believe right after the R426 administrative code that you mentioned, it says a person in the employ of Arizona State University, Northern Arizona University, the University of Arizona, or another regionally accredited university in the state, if the services are part of the faculty duties of that person's salary position and the person is participating in a graduate program, all of that applied.
Correct. So what that means is that she's not practicing without a license, but it doesn't give her the authority to be a qualified supervisor under the rule. So that's kind of the position that we're kind of in right now, is that that particular statutes pertaining to Dr. Batout Ganji's practice herself, saying she would not be practicing without a license if she was providing services under the umbrella of what ASU is asking her to provide services to. That part is where that exemption applies. That exemption doesn't carry over then and say, well, your supervisor then doesn't have to be licensed if they're exempt from licensure, because the rule clearly states, nope, the supervisor has to be licensed. So she can be exempt from licensure, but then she can't supervise you toward certification. Somebody else that is licensed would have to. So they read a little bit different because of the intent of why they're in there. And they don't connect to each other. It's that particular exemption is specific to her practice and her authority to practice in the state, versus qualifications of a supervisor, which is a different topic.
Okay, any other discussion for that?
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I'm concerned about the format that ASU is currently running this program, because I'm concerned that this is not the only applicant that's in this position. I think that this is something that we've worked with other universities nationwide to have these conversations about as well, because we've had applicants come forward in very similar situations. And we've had multiple circumstances over the last 2, 3, 4 years where we've had to recommend or provide the opportunity for applicants to withdraw their application, because we don't want to deny it and it be a penalty. Like this is a complex issue. It's, you know, there's a lot in this. But I mean, I remain concerned that even at all the way up to the university level, that we've got a university that is not familiar with the statute and is thus essentially putting students in kind of this bind of it. There's a lot of directions I could go with it. I think because she's working in a school setting, this doesn't negate the fact that the rule's clear and we would not be able to approve her license at this time. That's one piece of it. But then if we look at then the other pieces that trickle down from that of who is the client and what does the law say about the practice of behavior analysis in Arizona, which in Arizona, it says in order to practice behavior analysis, you must be licensed or supervised by somebody who's licensed. Now there's those exceptions. And so I think because we also have an exception that says if you're duly certified by the Department of Education, you could provide these services. So I don't think that this is a similar issue like she's practicing without a license, that Ms. Robinson is, because she is also a certified teacher. So she has the ability to provide those services as a certified teacher. I could see issues with the way that ASU's program is worded. What happens if this was like a HAB provider providing services in a group home or, you know, a group home direct care staff? And then do we have that kind of leniency to say, well, this person, I mean, that person would be essentially practicing without a license, because to me, it's pretty clear that you must be licensed or supervised by someone who's licensed. And even though there's that exemption that says, well, if ASU has this as a practicum program, then we're covered. My concern is the actual member and what happens if there's a complaint or harm done or a potential thought that harm could be done. Who does that complaint go to? Does that supervisor at ASU, you know, take that on? And then do we say, well, we don't have authority over them because they're exempt? Or I'm concerned that the way that it's being interpreted by ASU is a public protection concern in this case. But then in other cases, I'm equally concerned that there's probably several students, and not just Arizona, maybe even possible other states, that are going to run into issues with becoming licensed because their supervisors aren't licensed in the state in which they're practicing.
I would love to respond to that if the board is okay.
Yeah, I would be okay with that.
So thank you for that. And I appreciate that. And I will say because I coordinate the practicum and I know every single one of the students who are in it now and who have gone through it, this is a unique situation for Sarah Robeson only. There are no other students who have completed the practicum in a setting in Arizona whose direct supervisor in the practicum was not a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona. We even have had people move into Arizona in the middle of the practicum, and we've moved them to new supervisors to ensure that they continue to be supervised by someone who is licensed in Arizona. Sarah's unique situation was such that we had a licensed Arizona behavior analyst on her contract with whom I met. We have meetings weekly with the supervising team. We see ourselves as a multiple supervisor site. My name is on every single person's contract that's in the practicum. And so for that reason, we felt like that for Sarah, that was her licensed behavior analyst, I guess, would be the other individual on the contract. But I recognize your point. And I think your point is a good one. It's not something that we have concern about with any of the other students right now in our practicum, but I see your point for other providers, especially given that I understand now that you all have explained it. The wording says that that's practice, not supervision, but because that wasn't explicit, it could be easily interpreted potentially. So I bet I do appreciate the board taking the time and the executive committee taking time to look into this matter more fully. I know it's incredibly important, obviously, to Sarah as well as myself.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, that makes me feel, I appreciate that clarification because it does make me feel much better to know that this is a unique situation. And hopefully hearing this conversation will help prevent any other individuals from being in a similar boat. And I think that especially, and I'm glad to hear that you're over the practicum program too, so it's not you then having to relay a message to somebody else. So thank you for being here and for clarifying that. That helps.
Okay, so let's discuss some possible options. What does the committee see as some plans moving forward, some direction moving forward?
This is Jean Galvin. You could allow the applicant to withdraw her application so she wouldn't have a denial on her record. Kathy, I don't know what our time frames are, what we have left. If you could table this and allow her time to obtain additional hours that would be under the supervision.
That is a possibility. Once the first additional information request is sent, she will have 240 days, and plus she can request a 30-day extension from there. I don't know if that gives her enough time to complete her hours. But we could also, if she chooses to withdraw, if it's agreeable to Heidi and the committee, is allow her to withdraw and then let the application fee be applied to her application when she resubmits it, rather than having to pay another $350.
And Mr. Chair, committee members, one other option we can look at is whether there are any of the waivers that are tied to COVID-19 that may afford her some additional time. I don't know if that's the case yet. I think we would need to do some careful analysis. But that may give her the extra time to complete the deficit in the hours of supervision. I'd be happy to take a look at that.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. Yeah.
And I mean, it's not really from our decision, but one of the hardest parts, I think, for me, and when we're dealing with this particular issue, is that the supervision of those 1500 hours has already been paid for. And so hopefully it's something that ASU can help coordinate or work out with the individual, because I mean, we have the rule is the rule, right? And so we don't have the flexibility to make an exception. We don't have that flexibility here. And so hopefully that that's something that can be considered. And then of course, if you know, she's teaching in a classroom, there's again, a small exception for her job to be able to continue to do her job in her capacity as a BCBA in the classroom as a certified teacher. She just wouldn't be able to take that outside of that role until she's met those 1500 hours. And so I wonder if it would be helpful, and probably not the way we typically do things, but I wonder if it would be helpful to explain to Ms. Robinson what the choices on the table are, such as, you know, we could allow for her the time to do it, or she could withdraw. We could apply the fee to the next application or what have you. Because for some students, having that application kind of linger and that time frame linger is stressful on top of other stress that they're going to experience with this. So I wonder if there's feedback that Ms. Robinson has about, you know, whether it would make more sense to withdraw the application, knowing that we'll apply the fee to the next application, or if that extension is something she's comfortable with, where we could say, look, you'll get the 240 days. If that's not enough, then you could get, you could request an extension. So we're not just adding more stress to an already stressful situation.
And Dr. Davis-Wilson, you suggested that that might be laid out in a follow-up letter with those possible options for Ms. Robinson to select?
No, I think we would need to make, ultimately we're the ones that need to make the selection. I'm just asking for her feedback. Because I think we need to make the decision. And I think the sooner we make it so that she can start remediating it and getting in a direction that is of benefit to her, the better. But I'm just curious if at this time she would like to provide any feedback about whether or not it would be more helpful for us to have the recommendation of withdraw the application and we'll apply the fee, or if she would like the extra time, knowing that she'll have the 240 days plus an option to request an extension to get those hours done. I think the 240 days is going to fall a little bit short, but I think with the additional extension request, I think she could get all of those hours done.
Yeah, I need now 1,370 hours. So clearly I need 240 plus days. And I will say the statute is not clear.
So Ms. Robinson, would it be more helpful then for us to allow for you to withdraw that application? Again, you wouldn't have to pay another fee when the time was done and you're resending that, or would you like to have us just wait out the time to see if you can get the hours done?
I don't know at this stage.
Okay. Let me do a little bit of math on it, because Ms. Folks, after the 240 days, how many extensions can she get? Is it only the one? So we'd be looking at 270 days?
As far as I know, yes.
Yes, that's my understanding. This is Jean Galvin. You could make a motion to the effect that you would give the applicant 10 business days to either withdraw her application or notify the board that she requests the 240 days that would be permissible under the licensing timeframe rules for her to complete those additional hours. And if we do not hear from her within those 10 days with respect to what option she wants to select, then her file would just be closed and she would have to apply anew.
May I ask a quick question? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah.
With regard to the hours, so Ms. Robinson has already her BCBA. She has passed the exam and had the 1,506 counted for that. With the 1370 that she now needs to meet the Arizona requirement, what additional or different rules may apply in terms of maximum hours per month, percentage of supervision? Would it be possible for her to expedite this in some way by extra supervision, extra working time, something to that effect? Do y'all follow what I'm asking?
We align all of our other standards with the BACB. So really the only difference between the BACB standards that we look at is that it has to be a licensed individual. So everything else, the mins, the max, the percentage, everything else is the same as the BACB's supervised independent field work, which is the 1500 hours.
And I know that we only had 130 hours signed by Ms. Nafisi, who is an LBA in Arizona, but in looking back at this, I know that Sarah did meet with Nicole on other occasions. I believe Nicole looked at some of the videos, Sarah, that you had done throughout the practicum course as part of that collaboration as a multi-supervisor team. But I always signed it simply because Sarah was part of my group of students. So the way that the platform you guys at ASU, you know, Canvas has them set up, and she was in my Canvas group. So I'm the one that signed her paperwork. If we were able to find documentation that I assume she must have in her unique documentation system of having met with Nicole more than that 130, of Nicole having observed some more of her supervision, would she be able to retrospectively, with Nicole's signature, submit more hours for consideration?
So long as there's documentation. So I would caution the creation of any documentation. So if you go back and she watched a video but didn't document it, but so long as there's documentation of the feedback that meets the supervision standards, then yeah, we generally do not say, we generally will say, don't say like, oh, you originally only said 130, so that's all you get. If you have documentation that says otherwise, but it just made more sense for you to fill out the BACB form the way that you did or whatever, it's not uncommon for us to request that. And Ms. Galvin, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we could also include that in the letter to the applicant, in that give the 10 days or what have you, to allow her that opportunity to report on what additional hours she has documentation from a licensed supervisor. Because of the requirement of the contract, it would have to be just that licensed supervisor. So she finds hours that maybe a different person subbed in or what have you, and those people aren't on the original contract, then that could be problematic. But I think that, and I totally understand in the group supervision type models, there's a lot of overlap. And so sometimes it just makes sense to just have one person signing, but that doesn't mean that the work wasn't done in collaboration with others. And so I think if that documentation is there, that could be a part of the motion to say, like, we would allow for her to also say, like, here are the additional hours that I have documentation for.
We appreciate that. Again, it is a very unique situation with Sarah, and we really were under the impression that we were following the rules. And frankly, I can speak for me, and I feel quite certain, Sarah, when I tell you that we're very surprised to find that we ultimately were not following the rules. It was not our intention. Obviously, we would never put anyone in this position. So my sincere, you know, thank you to everyone who's taking the time to really help us better understand this. And of course, apologies for having taken up so much time, and also to Sarah for the confusion that we have had.
And Mr. Stenoff, Mr. Chair, if I can, I also would just like to mention, we do have representation here today from our professional association. This is a topic that we have brought up with the professional association multiple times. And so I do encourage you guys to, if you're not already a part of the professional association, either as a student member or to become a part of the professional association and to work with them on, this is something that I know that we've really expressed the importance that as an association, they should, you know, consider educating their members around this issue. And I know that's why they're, you know, they're coming to these meetings on a regular basis. The other thing that as a university you may want to consider as someone who's doing the practicum, you may, you know, the public records for all of these meetings are available on the website. And you can even listen to prior meetings that we've had with other university instructors or other circumstances in which we've seen similar cases like these come forth. And those meeting minutes are available too. So not that you probably have a ton of free time, but if you know, you've got a student looking for an ethics project or something that you can kind of go back and look through these things to just help educate, because this has been something over the last 3 years we've had multiple conversations about. And obviously I don't expect you to be at all of the conversations, right? But I think maybe in looking at some of that historical stuff, like, it might be helpful to see what has kind of transpired over the years. And then of course, working with the professional association on how to better educate the members on this, because I call it the unintended consequences of licensing our profession, is that, you know, I don't think we understood just how rigid the legislative system works as far as statutes and rules and articles and what each piece means and how they're interpreted, which is why, I mean, even on these meetings, which is why we have an attorney who even helps us interpret them, right? So there's a lot of complexity to it, but it's, even though we don't feel good making these decisions, like our hands are kind of tied with them. So anything that you guys can do as a university to go back and kind of look at those things or work with the associations to kind of educate yourselves, like that would help tremendously for the students, for yourselves, but also because this has been kind of a point of heartbreak for us in multiple meetings where this has happened to multiple applicants, and it's not fun and it doesn't feel good. But we don't have very many options ourselves, because that's just how the rules and licensure works. So thank you for being here and for being humble in accepting the feedback.
I appreciate it. And it's good to hear that Aitsiyama isn't involved. I didn't realize that they were connected with you guys. So I certainly will reach out to them in future if we need something.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I have a question.
Yeah.
For Ms. Nafizi, to when she sends in verification of any additional hours, those hours should include the 130 they know for sure, correct?
Yeah.
And then did the committee also want the logs, the supervision log?
I think that would probably be a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So yes, answer.
Okay.
And this is Jean Galvin. I know earlier we had discussed giving the applicant perhaps 10 days to either withdraw, submit additional hours. You may want to offer her a little bit of additional time than 10 days. That doesn't seem very long when she has more than one option to consider.
I agree with that. I'll go ahead and make a motion that we direct board staff to supply a letter to Ms. Robinson indicating the hours that we are unable to count towards licensure at this time, and providing her with options to choose whether or not she would like to withdraw her application and that withdrawal would include the ability to apply that fee to a reapplication, so she's not out that money, or to use the timeline that's set forth, which looks like it's going to be about 270 days to get those hours complete, of which her application would remain open during that time, and then she would just notify the board once those hours are done. As part of that time, we would also be looking, or as part of that letter, we would also be looking for additional hours that she may be able to count from the licensed supervision. And I know we said 10 days is too short. Do we want to, can we do 30 days?
Yeah, I that would be my suggestion.
Yeah.
Ms. Galvin, is there any issue with that 30-day window?
No, 30 days is fine, because this letter will serve a request for additional information. And I would ask that if we do not hear from her within 30 days, then the application will be closed and the fund, the fees will be non-refundable.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that extension.
And that was in the form of a motion.
Yeah, so
I'll that motion.
Okay. So all in favor, say aye.
We have discussion first.
Sorry, Dr. David. Yeah,
discussion. So my discussion point is just simple. I think we need to get the online ASU program on the agenda for our next meeting, just to kind of have this discussion and put a bow on this, just as we did with the other national groups that came forward with some of their questions. I want to make sure that we don't have any other, you know, as much as like this is quote unquote the outlier, every one of these outliers, this is a not a great situation for us to be in. We need behavior analysts practicing in a state. We want to provide this applicant due diligence. And in doing so, we find this kind of one-off. We need to make sure that ASU is aligned with the rule and statute that has been in place now for a significant period of time. And I just think that that needs to be noted by board staff so that we can get that scheduled. Thank you. End of discussion for me.
I agree with that. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Davis Wilson.
If I may, I again want to reiterate appreciation for both the supervisor being present and being again humbled in the feedback, but also Ms. Robinson, please know that again, these are not fun decisions for us to make. This is not a fun position for us to be in, and that we have several good stories of individuals who have been in this situation, who have gone, they've gotten their additional hours, they've become licensed, and they're doing great things in the field. So please know that we are rooting for you. We're, you know, anything that we can do to help kind of support you in the next 30 days to get it sorted out. Board staff is going to be there to support you. And again, we really are hopeful that this is a resolution, while not ideal, one that'll get you on track to be able to practice and serve the community. So thank you for your time and thank you for being here.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Okay, so any further discussion? Okay, so all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I believe I'm next. However, the application has something that we'll have to kind of dive a little bit into that could take 10 or 15 minutes. So it'd be great if we could maybe take a convenience break before we do that.
Yeah, would 10 minutes be adequate for everybody?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, I will need to exit before we return. So I just want to make that note to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Reitz.
Thank you, everyone.
You, and just, you know, as we get to that application, please make sure you look at the supervision dates that were uploaded by board staff per my request. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we recessed then?
We are recessed. So let's get back together, readjourn, whatever we, not readjourn. Let's start up again.
Let's fire this up. Is it am I up there, Mr. Chair?
What? Say it again.
Am I on with the application for Terry Julian?
Actually, no.
Oh.
No, Mr.
Chair, Appian. I was confused.
Oh.
Yeah.
You went ahead.
Are you getting anxious?
I just knew I had a lot to talk about, so I was getting nervous.
Well, that's exciting. We'll have to have a cliffhanger, and Ms. Denton will need to address Mr. Hasty, please.
Fair enough.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stephen Hassian passed his exam on May 31st, 2019. He attended Arizona State University's online program, where he obtained his Master's of Education in Curriculum and Instruction in Early Childhood Education from Mary Lou Fullerton's Teachers College. So looking at this, he graduated in December of 2015. His supervision dates were from October 18th, 2015 to November 19th, 2016. He practiced, or he had his supervision in the state of California for a total of 1,620 hours under 2BCBAs practicing in California, which does not require licensure. At this time, I don't see any concerns, unless any other committee members do see any concerns.
Any members? Okay. Dr. Davis Wilson.
Do I need to move forward?
No, we'll do a group. Yeah, group. One motion is
perfect.
Yeah, Dr. Davis Wilson.
It sounded like somebody had a question. I thought somebody tried to chime in.
Any questions? Okay. Dr. Davis Wilson.
Thanks.
Ms. Cessna passed her exam in May of 2016. She graduated from Kaplan, now Purdue Global's ABA program, in January of 2016. Her supervision occurred, so I was going to summarize her supervision, but her supervision's where I'm also trying to navigate. So it appears that Ms. Cessna was practicing in Florida, but supervised by a licensed supervisor out of Texas. Florida does not have a licensing requirement, so those hours should be fine. The supervisor did identify that they were licensed in question number 9 of their form, but it appears to be potentially a Texas license, not Florida, and Florida doesn't require licensure, so I'm not super concerned about that. The one thing that kind of stood out to me, she did her 1500 hours, but the dates of the 1500 hours were past certification. So January 1st, 2020 through January 1st, 2021. And so I was a little bit curious as to why. And I looked through all the documentation. I didn't see anything that would indicate that either date could be wrong. So I'm just a little confused myself. So my recommendation would probably be to do a request for information and just get a written explanation as to why supervision was done. 1500 hours of supervision was done after certification.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I have a question on that. Is it, I was under the impression, and I may have even told her, that the hours don't have to be the ones that they use for their BCBA. They can do additional hours if their BCBA hours are not going to meet Arizona requirements.
That's correct. My concern, though, is, and if that is the case, then I'd want to see the supervision logs to make sure that the supervision was done to a statutory level. Because my concern is that if she was in Florida practicing, that supervision may not be the prescribed supervision like it would be toward certification, like the 1500 hours every, you can only count, 130 per month. You have to have so many contacts per month. You have to have a signed contract. I'm concerned. So yeah, they can count those hours, but they would still all have to fall under the requirements for those hours. And I'm concerned that if she was already a practicing BCBA for 4 years, that they might not meet the BACB standards. Now that would be different. And we've seen this before where like someone's done their 750 hours and then they want to relocate to Arizona or become licensed in Arizona, and they have to redo 750 hours or count 750. But usually when we talk to them, we let them know that it still has to, there's still hours that have to meet the BACB requirements. And my concern is I would want to see the supervision logs and documentation to confirm that those hours truly do meet those requirements.
All right. Thank you.
And if we're going to do a request for information, the other thing that kind of stuck out to me was that this individual's position was that of a C-level position in an organization where a director of the same organization was her supervisor. And so I would like to see if there was some explanation of that to the BACB back in the day to make sure that there was not any conflict of interest there. Because in my reading of it, everything's been done with positive behavior supports where she essentially was the chief, correct? Or am I missed? Did I miss? Yeah, it's supervised experience was there as a chief operations title.
Well,
correct.
Dr. Davey, my guess is her BACB supervision hours were done at behavioral building blocks.
Oh, but that's your, is that what you're assuming? Because the supervision signature is from a Lindsay Hauer, right?
Well, that's my concern, is that she's so she's essentially submitting an additional 1500 hours under Lindsay, and
it's the same point. Yeah, same point, Dr. Davis Wilson. I'm just concerned
I agree.
Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and then to have your subordinate signing off on those 1500 hours. So if we're going to ask the questions, and let's get that cleared up as well as my statement.
Yeah. So Ms. Folks, I think your understanding of the hours, them being able to accrue additional hours, makes sense. But again, they can't accrue them from a subordinate, and they can't accrue them outside of the BACB requirements. They can't just simply have someone sign off on 1500 hours just because they've been employed at a place for a year. And that's my, to me, that's what this looks like. It doesn't look like it meets the BACB requirements. But to Dr. Davies' point, it does look like there was potentially an experience at one point that did meet the BACB requirements, which is likely why certification happened. But we would either need to see those hours, or if she's, which I do believe Kaplan does allow for a practicum experience at 1,000 hours, or we would need to see that the supervision was not done by a subordinate, and that it meets those requirements. So absolutely, I'm glad you brought that up, Brian, because even if she sent something in, I would still be concerned about the nature of the roles.
Committee members, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, committee members, for the additional information request letter, should I also, besides asking for supervision logs, ask for a copy of the signed contract?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah. Dr. Davy, was there any additional information besides what Ms. Folks just listed? Okay.
Well,
I want to make sure that all that got
in. Dr. Davis, I think an explanation of whether or not she had a subordinate, was providing her supervision.
Yeah.
I think we have to get some clarification on that, because that is not allowed.
All right. Any other concerns?
My puppy seems to be concerned. I'm sorry. I will mute myself.
That's right. My baby has been concerned all day as well.
And Dr. Davies, it is your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, we're going to take a look at application for Terry Julian. Application was completed in its entirety. We have an individual who went to University of North Florida, received a master's in educational leadership, and then FIT for their BACB requirements. The question that I really had for the individual, and I reached out to Kathy earlier this week when I was reviewing applications, was around the supervised experience. And we've had this issue before. So if you're on the PDF, I would just ask that you entertain me by following along. If we look at the final experience verification form, which is on page, I'm going to make sure I'm on my PDF and not looking at it through Google, which is on page 13 of 29. We have four supervisors listed for this individual, for Terry Julian, during this period. And I think we came up with this question in a previous meeting. The dates of when those supervisions is not listed on this form, which I think is a disservice by the BACB. And we may want to reach out to them through our contacts with Misty, because these individuals all have differing dates of one, when they are certified, and two, when they are allowed to provide supervision per BACB guidelines and their 8-hour coursework. And that's going to get even stickier now when we think about the future of the BACB requiring a certain period of time, a certain lengthy period, before you're allowed to supervise new BCBAs, which we know is coming online in the future. And so in looking at these dates, I go through and I take a look at their registry requirements. And for many of them, there are no issues. So for example, on this form, the first supervisee, Derek, falls in line. The other supervisor, Melissa, falls in line. But when we get to Mr. Dillander, we have an issue with his supervision period, right? His supervision, he was not cleared to supervise until 4-2 of 19. And when we look at the form that's provided to us, by staff will see that, you know, they just get in there with, you know, 4/23/19. So the individual, you know, 2 days difference, right? I'm not overly concerned about a 2 day lapse. He started super, or, you know, it's like, it's that close, 2 days difference. Like, that's fine. The issue really comes in, and I'm sorry, that's just a point of how close it's cutting it, right? 21st to the 23rd on the documentation. The issue then becomes Victoria Vaith, who, if you scroll down in the next set of applications or the next set of documents starting on page 20, this individual, you'll see if you go to page 23, was eligible to provide supervision starting on 7/2. So a 28-day now gap between those periods. And so I just think that we need to pay attention to those dates. And I just want to put it on our radar that, you know, I had to go back to Kathy and ask for this information. And I'm wondering if, you know, as we review this documentation, do we want to talk about getting this information proactively when the BACB forms are used and there's multiple supervisors? And I'm not saying that, you know, everyone looks at, I mean, I know you guys' own due diligence, you look at when those competencies are completed, you look at when supervision starts, but if we don't have this information, it kind of puts Kathy on a wild goose chase in the last week before the meeting. And so I'm just wondering how we deal with this on a go forward basis. Other than that, you know, that's really the applicant's form is completed, have no issues, just, you know, the fact that there's 8 supervisors with varying supervising periods that we're just not aware of until we ask for further communication.
Dr. Davey, are you comfortable with this application going forward, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
your point is well taken. It is confusing, and it's not very easy to follow who did what when, and so. But yeah, I think we should have further discussion about this, or discussion in the future about it. So, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, if they used the psychology board forms, one supervisor could have signed the entire form, and we wouldn't even know that there were 8 other supervisors involved. Which kind of makes it even a little bit more of a challenge, right? Because then it's kind of like, well, then don't turn in your BACB forms, have your one supervisor sign this other form. And then we won't know that you had 8 different supervisors, and we won't know to what status those supervisors met the BACB requirements. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's tough. But then when they turn in that form, you're right. Like, once we have that information, then it's like, well, we need the whole picture.
Yeah.
And so then is there like a supplemental document to the other document or something that Kathy fills out ahead of time? Or is it that if the BACB, which this is problematic, but I'm just in discussion, if the BACB approved those hours, then they've essentially deemed those supervisors appropriate.
Yeah. And so I guess, you know, to that question is, do I stop asking Kathy for this information and just say, I assume the BACB double checked that? Or I believe in my due diligence, like, I want to know, like, if you're going to list those 4 supervisors across the period of time, I want to know they were legit in that period of time. Right. So I would have a hard time just advocating my role and due diligence just to the BACB, and that's an issue for me.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I'm just, like I said, that's why I just think with part of the discussion, that's the hard part, is that other form could be filled out and bypass all of it.
Yep, no, I agree. But by accepting the BACB documentation, we've kind of set ourselves up to look at that. And I don't understand why the BACB, you know, they probably have the internal documentation to be able to pull that, look at it, and cross-references, where we have to have some additional time. So, you know, maybe we move this to a discussion piece, but I just wanted to bring it up with this particular example, because there were 2 different final verification forms with a total of, you know, 8 different supervisors with different, you know, periods of time. And I thought it was a good chance for us to kind of move this maybe into an item for further discussion. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other, excuse me, any other concerns? Okay. All right, thank you, Dr. Davey. Next application is Ms. Grabowski. She received her BCBA certification in September of 20. She graduated in June of 2018 from Grand Canyon University with a Master of Science in Psychology and received a grad certificate in Positive Behavior Supports from NAU in May of 20. She received 1,538 hours of supervision under Andrew Wade, who is an LBA in Arizona. I did not know any concerns. Did any committee members note any concerns? Okay. And I recommend that we move forward to the board for approval. And then Ms. Denton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lopez Alvarez passed her exam in November of 2020. She received a Master of Intervention, ABA in Autism from ABA España in October of 2019. This is an online learning platform providing a verified course sequence recognized by the Association for Behavior Analysis International. Her supervision dates occurred from January 2019 to December 2000. I have a typo on my form. Let me double check, because I'm presuming it wasn't in 1 month. Thank you. I'm getting there. If any other committee members see the date of supervision before I do, feel free to chime in.
Ms. Denton, what was the question again?
I'm looking for the dates of supervision in my typed notes. I had listed the wrong. Oh no, it's right.
Okay. On page 21,
thank you.
30 is the final experience verification form.
Thank you. Okay, so dates were from January 2019 to December of 2019. So I had the dates just backwards. Okay, so she obtained her supervision at American Behavioral Solutions under Megan Merritt, who is an LBA in the state of Arizona. She totaled 1530 hours, so she met that requirement. For other committee members who reviewed this application, you will note that she did complete her coursework overseas by an overseas agency. So with this, all of the documentation from those agencies were translated by the credentialing translation service Joseph Silney and Associates. That I was provided additional information by board staff on. I did a quick cursory review and learned a lot about this. Yet Joseph Silney and Associates is the one who translated all of the documentation for Ms. Lopez Alvarez. Board staff noted that this translation service that was used is a well-known to the psych board, that they have documents on file going all the way back to 1999, the member of NASA and NASIS, and he's the past chairman of this organization that assists in translation. So it appears that the translation service is a well-qualified translation service. Through looking through all of the documentation, the coursework, the dates of supervision, they all line up. Any concerns by other committee members?
Mr. Chair, if I may just provide a little bit of clarity with respect to meeting requirements for licensure for an educated. We did look at the board's rules to see if this was addressed in the rules. And what we learned was that there's only a rule specific to psychologist applicants. But that being said, this particular applicant appears to have met that the requirement established by that rule. So in consultation with board counsel, We concurred that it's reasonable, or that we can take away from this that the applicant made a reasonable attempt to demonstrate she's met the qualifications, even if there isn't a rule prescribing as such. So that's one more piece of evidence that you can confidently review this file.
Thank you, Ms. Bakanon. So any other comments on this application? Okay. And then Ms. Galvin, can we do a whole group after the universal recognition application if it meets our requirements? Well, why don't we go ahead and do it anyway?
Let's do it.
All right.
Can we get in trouble?
So, item B, Behavior Analyst Application for Licensure by Universal Recognition. Dr. Davis Wilson, would you please summarize that for us?
Yeah. Ms. Moore is requesting licensure by Universal Application. It is important to note that she is currently licensed in good standing in Oregon. She has supplied us with proper records to establish residency. She has, however, answered yes to question number 8 relating to having been charged or convicted or awaiting trial for a charge of which she provided documentation related to a resolved DUI conviction from 2012. I have no concerns with this application and would move for it to be forwarded to the full board for approval.
All right, any concerns from any other, or any concerns from committee members? I just noted one, and I don't think this is that big a deal. I'm just bringing it up. In the letter addressing affirming question number 8, the dates don't match the reports from the police, from the documentation there. The documentation, the police documentation indicated the year of 2013, and the letter is documented 2012. So that was just a discrepancy there. I don't know if it's a big deal or if it's even worth pursuing, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
I'm fine with it. I think
yeah,
it's resolved. It's been resolved for several years. You know, with that, even with that date, I would be fine with it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, do we have a motion to move the applications? If somebody could enumerate those for us to move forward to the board, can we get a motion to move those applications forward?
And it would be all of them with the exception of Ms. Robinson, correct?
And Ms. Cessna.
And Cessna. Okay, so I'll make the list. So I'll move that Diaz, Corley, Eisenman, Johnson, Kamen, Horner, Bardman, Holt, Gilbert, Rosneros, Hassin, Young Julian, Grabowski, and Alvarez and Moore be moved to the full board for licensure.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Okay, those applications move forward.
I do believe we need to make a motion on the other two. I can entertain, or I'll make the motion that we, should we do them? I don't know if Jean's back on. Can we do them separate? Yeah, let's just do them separate. I'll make a motion that we direct board staff to send a letter to Ms. Robeson with her options for withdraw and 30 days, the opportunity to have 30 days to review her supervision records and get back to the board.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. All right, somebody make a motion for the other one.
Yeah, I'll make a motion that we move or we direct board staff to provide a request for additional information for Ms. Cessna. And that request would be specific to records, supervision records for the dates of January 1st, 2020 through January 1st, 2021, as well as an explanation related to the role of the supervisor in a potential subordinate position to the individual seeking licensure.
Okay, great. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
All right. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Good. Motion carries. All right. Agenda item number 6, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding potential recommendation of the board to open a complaint against Jeffrey R.W. Siegel. Ms. Hackenon, do you want to summarize that for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The committee requested that this matter be placed on this agenda for purposes of determining whether to open a complaint. This matter came before or came to your attention through the process of performing a substantive review of the application file of Tracy Harris. Within that file were several instances of documented attempts on the part of both Ms. Harris and also Ms. Folks to reach out to Mr. Siegel to obtain his supervision verification documentation to support Ms. Harris's file. When the file came before you, Mr. Siegel had not supplied any responses to those multiple attempts. However, in the process of investigating Mr. Siegel's whereabouts, we learned that he was formerly employed by an agency, a local agency, where a very prominent member of the professional association currently works. We solicited her assistance in potentially reaching out to him and trying to forge a connection to locate him. That effort appeared to have yielded some success in that finally on February 22nd, he did respond to Ms. Folks with the requested documentation. However, he did not supply any information for, relative to the delay or his failure to respond to any of the earlier requests. We noted that he most recently renewed his behavior analyst license in May of 2020. His database record reflects Arizona addresses. However, the form that he did submit to the board office on February 22nd reflects a California address. So it appears that he has not filed a timely change of address with this board. We reached out to him to notify him of this matter appearing on the agenda, requested his presence, and requested that he submit the change of address to us formally. We did not hear from him until 9:15 this morning, at which time he finally responded to the board's emails. He indicated that he did supply the change of address form, but and he indicated that emails from the board have been sent to a spam folder, and that's why he has not been responsive. He indicated that he feels terrible, that so many individuals have tried to reach him and he wasn't aware of it. He admitted moving to California and stated that he has not received any phone calls from us. He provides assurance that he will continue to receive emails going forward, and he has issued apologies to the applicant and wants to extend that apology to anyone else whose time has been wasted. I have indicated in the memorandum two statutes that I think the committee will want to review, 32-2091 subsection 12BB, stating it is unprofessional conduct to fail to furnish information in a timely manner to the board, and also the statute 32-2066, which requires a timely change of address. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
And I do just want to add that Mr. Siegel indicated in his email to me this morning that he would be unable to attend today's meeting.
Hey, any comments from the committee?
I for one, think that, you know, this is violation of both the statutes that Heidi just outlined. I mean, I don't understand how all of a sudden it's not in spam and he's able to respond to us through his Gmail. I don't understand how he's, you know, so many people have tried to contact him. Are all those going to spam? Like, I'm not super thrilled that he's still licensed in Arizona, so we still have jurisdiction over him. And I'm not sure his his 5-line email to us is a sufficient response. And I'm not sure how many other applicants are out there trying to reach him right now. So I have genuine concerns with this behavior.
I agree. And I think we saw a similar situation and we did choose to move it to open a complaint on the case. And part of that was to get the individual before us so that we can talk about the seriousness of these concerns and the impact, because it's not just that time was wasted. Had there not been, which we have some now, but had there not been some of the little bits that we've done in the rules to allow for some workarounds, this could have completely halted an individual's ability to practice. And you know, three, four years ago, those rules didn't exist. And so this individual would still be trying to get in touch with them. It affects their career. It affects our huge access to service needs. I mean, it's not just a waste of time. This is preventing services to the members that need to get services is the overall effect. But I also think it doesn't appear that while I appreciate the extension of kind of wanting to apologize, it doesn't appear that that's a genuine apology, being that, I mean, we got notified 15 minutes before this meeting. And until this point, nobody has heard a thing from this individual. So for me, the precedence alone of the fact that we've seen similar cases and we've moved forward with requesting that they come forth to the committee as a complaint, I would be in support of moving forward.
So I'd like to move, we can enter into discussion, but I'm going to make the motion that complaint be filed and that the individual be notified of the complaint being open.
I'll second.
We have a second.
I believe, just to clarify, it would be a recommendation to the board to open a complaint against Mr. Siegel. This committee does not have the statutory authority to open complaints.
Well, then we'll make the motion, I guess. If that's accurate, which I did not doubt you, Ms. Michelson, then I will make the recommendation that we ask the full board to move forward with that complaint at the next meeting.
And do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All right. Any further discussion?
I think the two statutes or rules that were identified are sufficient. I was quickly just looking through BACB rules as well. With like responsibility to other behavior analysts, and I haven't had a chance to scan it, but if I find one, I'll chime in.
And I would like an opportunity to ensure that the sites are correct. I understand the intent of your motion, but I want to make sure before that referral is made to the board that we have the correct statutory or regulatory sites. But I can do that after this meeting, before the referral is made.
Okay. I mean, I don't, for the others on the call, 7.0, behavior analysts work with their colleagues within the profession of behavior analysis and from other professions and must be aware of these ethical obligations in all situations. I don't know. I thought there was a better one that said you were supposed to essentially be all you could be to other professionals, but I'm not finding one that makes me feel comfortable. So maybe just rolling with what we have from Arizona is appropriate.
Well, there is a, and I can't reach it at the very second, but there is one related to behavior analyst obligation to conform to the laws of their state as well.
9.01.
Yeah. And then, I think
I'd be comfortable with 9.01.
Yeah.
Because I think it's also important to put some teeth behind it. Like maybe next thing you know, we're going to see LBA dropped, but then it's our responsibility to roll this forward to the BACB. So I think it's important to see that it's not just the state of Arizona that would be concerned about this, but it's also looks to be concerning for the BACB as well.
And, you know, one of the kind of conversations, and it's not clearly, I guess, defined, in my opinion it is, but others may argue it, that a client in our ethics code is defined as any individual that's benefiting from the services we're providing. And so theoretically, a supervisee falls under a lot of the ethics code for that purpose, that as a supervisor, that supervisee in its interpretation is my client. And so I think the lack of having records available to, you know, an individual or a client that's requesting records is problematic. And like I said, I my computer's frozen and I have the code sitting right there, but I also have a sleeping beast preventing me from reaching across to get it. But I think there might be some language around that as well. Again, I think some people say, no, client is the actual recipient of services. I treat my supervisees like they're my clients, and I follow all of the ethics codes as if they're my clients.
Well, they are under a contract.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, we're providing them a service and they're benefiting from our service. So I think they fall under the contract, the definition.
I don't think there's a lot of gray space there. I think they're truly clients by the definition of client in the BACB compliance ethics code today as it's defined. I mean, the last part of that addendum is a clear description of what the client is, and the supervisee would be a client per that definition.
Yeah. And I think
a violation then of 2.0, where the behavior analysts have the responsibility to operate in the best interest of the client. And the client that reads the term client is used here in a broadly applicable to whomever the behavior analyst provides services, whether an individual or a parent or a guardian, organization, so on and so forth. So 2.0 and 9.01, I think, would be an appropriate addition to what Ms. Galvin's going to look at for the state of Arizona.
The statute does not appear, and the statute's definition of client does not appear to entail a supervisee, but that's something that we can consider later. We're just making the referral today.
The BACB's language does define client on page 23 of the code. If we want to reference that as a secondary piece, Ms. Galvin.
Yeah, so that would be like the unprofessional conduct DD violation of a code adopted by the board.
2.0 and 9.01.
I think I just totally rattled off that citation.
All right, so Ms. Galvin and board staff, do you guys have enough for that to move forward?
Yes. The violations that the committee has referenced are clear. 12BB, failing to provide information to the board or its representatives. 12K, as it relates to statute 32-2066 regarding the change of address. Jean, is that correct?
Yeah, no, but I understand what the board is going through, and we'll get the correct citations.
Okay, thank you. So, Dr. Stenoff, not to step on you, but I think we had a motion on the.
Yes, and I believe we had a second, correct? Or did we have a second? Okay. All right. Any further discussion? All right. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. The motion carries.
Ms. Galvin, just point of order. Do you think we need a roll call for that? Since this is kind of, you know, a big deal that we're making this recommendation.
No, you do not.
Okay.
Agenda item 7, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding unlicensed supervision provided by Samantha Lemons and Brandon Collins as identified in the application of Paige Hub. Ms. Pacanon.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. Would, even though the two individuals named in the agenda item, they're agendized together, but for purposes of your discussion, would you like for me to summarize each one separately and then allow you to discuss that particular individual's facts and circumstances. And then once you've made a decision about the first one, we can move on to the second one.
I would think that'd be probably best. So, because there might be some different circumstances with each.
Very good. Thank you. So again, this matter was requested by the committee to come back before you for purposes of determining what course of action to take. As you were reviewing the application for Paige Huff, there was their documentation within the file reflecting that two individuals who claim to have provided supervision to Ms. Huff may have not been licensed during that while providing supervisory services. So in the case of Brandy Collins, she is a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Texas. She is not licensed in Arizona. She sent correspondence to board staff in which she indicated that she provided remote supervision to Ms. Huff while Ms. Huff was in Arizona, and she was uncertain how to document that the supervision occurred remotely. She did not submit a verification form to that effect, so we only have her statement. However, the committee may wish to review this under the statute 322091.12 at subsection A, which states it's a class 2 misdemeanor for a person not licensed to engage in the practice of behavior analysis.
Committee, any discussion on that?
Silence.
I'm trying to gather my thoughts.
I know. Well, and I started to gather mine when I was reading through this earlier this week. Like that case in itself was generally difficult, and the findings in that are concerning with this particular individual, and the second one we'll go through. I guess my question back to the committee, my thought was, do we have all the information we would need to be able to decide whether or not this should go forward to a complaint and make the recommendation to the board, or do we still have some due diligence that we need to do on our side? Because again, I don't want this to feel like a witch hunt, you know, that we're going, you know, down these deep holes following an original complaint. But at the same time, it's our job to adjudicate these matters and give recommendations to the board. So I guess what I'm trying to articulate in a very unresponsive way is that I'm not sure I have enough info to feel comfortable at this point. And I'm not sure, and I'm not sure what other information I would want, because I'm thinking I'd love to ask these people some questions, but I know that can't happen outside of probably the complaint process.
Dr. Davey, would you want more evidence that this person did remote supervision without an Arizona license?
No, I think the discussion with them is that, you know, they stated that they provided that, and under what auspice did they think that that was okay, and what were their, you know, what was their, because, you know, and what was the frequency of that, and what was the timelines around that, and, you know, just being able to have the kind of detail around the quote unquote practice without a licensure in that state would make me feel a lot better. I forget off the top of my head how many hours this individual supervised during that time. And so it's just those kinds of details that would be in an investigative report that would be helpful. So I'm not really sure. And again, I don't know, and those of you that have been on the committee for a long time, I don't know that we've ever had something like this where we unearth something and decided then to kind of evaluate it in this forum.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, if I may, first of all, we saw a complaint and identified concerns with the supervisors. We added it to the agenda to consider and discuss further, and those two supervisors came forth and were mm-hmm. present during that discussion and were able to assist us in getting that additional information that we needed. that was enough to say, no, there were no statutory violations, but we've sorted that out. I think at this point we have enough evidence to say that a statute was violated. The one supervisor, it was a full 1500 hours. So it was a full year's worth of services plus. And I think that complaint screening process starts with the screen itself, which would allow for us to have kind of the investigative report, allow for us to have those interviews and conversations, and then make the determination of if we want it, you know, if we want to remediate it there or recommend it for informal interview or what have you. I think that the difference between the last situation where we said, ooh, we see these concerns with these supervisors and we need to talk about them or we need to review them for complaint, is that we had these concerns that had somewhat of a basis of hypothetical involved in them because of the responses we were getting from the BCBA that the complaint was against. But I felt that because they attended that meeting, they were able to say, no, here's how we do things. And we were able to say, like, well, maybe there wasn't statutory violation. In this case, I think the question before us is, was there a potential violation of a statute? And I don't know how to, I don't know what additional information would be needed to say yes or no when we have 1500 hours signed off on and no license by this individual. We have a document that this individual signed saying, yes, I did these services, but we have no license to support that they were licensed. So I think that that's kind of what
I guess what I'm trying to articulate, Dr. Wilson, is I don't know that, I mean, we have that information, but like the direct questioning of Ms. Collins, right, was kind of inside of the other situation. I mean, this, I think that's maybe where I'm struggling. It's like, I feel like I haven't had, and maybe it's through the complaint. Maybe you're right. Maybe there's enough info there that we need to get to have that conversation, and that conversation needs to be isolated within the complaint process. So I hear what you're saying.
Then that leads me to the question for board staff. Was Ms. Collins aware that we were meeting today?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davis-Wilson, she was not noticed of that fact.
Okay. So I'm just curious, Ms. Galvin, to because I completely understand what Dr. Davies is saying. And if I look at the other situation where we had a complaint and then it raised concerns about other professionals, we called those professionals forward. In this particular case, could we say like, hey, we'd like for you to come and be a part of this discussion, or would it need to go through the complaint process? Like, could we notice them that a potential discussion's happening so that they can answer questions? Or like I said, for me, I think what really divides it, because I understand what Dr. Davies, like there's that piece that's missing of like hearing the other side of the story. For me, what differentiates it again is that we have evidence of the statute violation, but could we call and ask them to come forth and answer those questions? Or
you could do that prior to opening a complaint. It would be voluntary. It may inform you to the point where you decide a complaint doesn't need to be opened, or it could help confirm your decision that a complaint should be opened. And the notice to them, they did not have to be provided notice for today's meeting, but the notice to them could state that based on the board's previous investigation of another case, they have concerns about, you know, these following issues, and they're inviting you to a meeting to discuss that. And please know that, you know, as a result of that discussion, a complaint could be opened, or the discussion could alleviate these concerns. Short answer, yes.
So would it make the most sense to table this item and request their presence, or do we need to split this? It sounds like we need to split this, right, and do two new requests. Because tabling it, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of the noticing, like if we table it, then we could essentially invite them back, but we'd want to probably split the conversation. I don't think we want to have the conversation with them together.
Dr. Davies, I would agree. So Ms. Galvin, my concern is that the facts in each of them are a little bit different. And so, for example, you know, with Ms. Collins, we have 1500 hours. never sought licensure. We don't know what other services have or haven't been provided. There's a lot of kind of unknowns. However, with Ms. Lemons, if I'm not mistaken, hers is far fewer hours, like a very minuscule amount of hours in comparison. And she is now licensed. And so kind of some of that may have been somewhat remediated.
So you could have them appear at the same meeting, schedule them for different times. The other individual wouldn't have to leave the public meeting. You could schedule them for different meetings. So there's a better chance that they would both not appear at the same time.
Oh, I'm not concerned that they would both appear at the same time. I'm just thinking like we want the discussion split into two different discussions. Temporally, it doesn't matter if it's all next Wednesday.
Okay, then that's fine. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to agendize as separate points for each person.
Yep, staff can do that.
Do others, I mean, again, I'm not trying to derail, but unless others feel strongly, like I just think a little bit more, because opening a complaint, I take that seriously in this position if we're going to recommend that to the board. And I agree there's a lot of things here I'm scratching my head over, but I want to make sure our ducks are in a row when we put individuals into kind of that protocol and that process, because we know that creates some hardships and some stress. So I would just feel personally a little better having a chance to speak to them.
I have a question, Ms. Galvin, I'm thinking about, because our kind of complaint screening process looks a little bit different than psychology board. So a complaint comes forward, it goes to the complaint screening committee. If the complaint screening committee votes to dismiss, then it's not like a reportable complaint of like, have you been investigated for, are you being investigated at that point, right? Or is it? Because I understand Dr. Davies' point. I'm teetering between resolving the issue as quickly as possible with also being cognizant that I don't want this to be like an automatic like ding that they're then reporting when we aren't confident in all the information.
Yeah, if a complaint is opened by staff, and whether it goes to the Committee on Behavior Analysts or it goes to the board's complaint screening committee, that is a complaint. And depending on how the question is worded, whether it's dismissed or it results in discipline, you would have to report that. If another state's application asks for that, it's not reportable as discipline, but you have been investigated. Simply inviting them to the meeting to talk about these concerns obviously is not a complaint.
Then Dr.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was gonna say, then I lean towards what Dr. Davies is suggesting.
My question is what information are we lacking that there was a code violation? And how extensive does our does our investigation to make a propose that the psych board evaluate this?
To answer, I mean, how extensive is your investigation? You can look at the question of whether to open a complaint as sort of a probable cause type of inquiry. Is there enough evidence to suggest that there could be a violation of statute or rule? And then make that referral, if you believe that's true, to the board. The board would have whatever material we have to date, a summary of staff, the minutes from this meeting, to make that assessment, whether to agree with that recommendation.
And then in the documentation for this discussion item, I didn't note any signed forms from Ms. Collins. Is that absent for a reason, or do we just not have it?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Folks can confirm that my understanding, which is we never received any form from Ms. Collins. We only received an inquiry, how would I fill out the form if I were to submit it, but we didn't actually receive anything.
Committee members, Mr. Stenhoff, as I remember it, I had explained to her regarding 404.2C, whatever it is, about supervisor requirement to be licensed in Arizona and what that means and what the committee has stated regarding remote supervision and where the supervised services are being provided. And I did not receive a response from her after that.
So I get, my question then is what evidence are we lacking that a complaint is warranted or not warranted?
I think if we look at it from a probable cause perspective, I understand kind of your question, Dr. Stenhoff, because we have enough probable cause to say they were practicing without a license. Well, one at least, with Ms. Lemons, it's so few hours that there's a possibility that that individual could have been associated with an agency and under the supervision of somebody else. So while those hours wouldn't count towards the individual's licensure, it doesn't necessarily deem that she was practicing without a license either.
So in this case, we need evidence that she was supervising, in fact, supervising from another state without a license remotely.
I mean, I think we have that evidence in form of a testimony from a supervisee.
And maybe I could just
further.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Dr.
I was just going to say, and maybe you now have helped me realize, I think what my concern was that these two were linked together. And I think that the Lemon situation is markedly different than the Collins situation. And I do think in one, the remote supervision piece, like I don't have a lot of questions about that. It's 1500 hours, it was wrong. The other one, I'm not so sure I feel like I'm like, that's wrong. Like, I don't think I know that information. So maybe it's the issue of that I was trying to combine them both to try to make some sort of jump in what the next step was. And they are markedly different. So maybe that's the issue. But I'm trying
So Dr. Davey, would you be comfortable if just focusing on Ms. Collins, could we, would it be okay to make a motion to move forward to the board to, possibly look at filing a complaint against this person? And then we can come back and talk about, Ms. Lemon. Not come back, but close this piece out and then pursue Ms. Lemon.
My personal, in the discussion, I think the 1500 hours of remote supervision is undeniable. And so I do feel more comfortable with that, moving forward with that as a complaint.
Okay. Do we have a motion then to move Ms. Collins forward to the board for a possible complaint?
So moved.
We have a second?
Second.
Any further discussion?
I just to reiterate, just for the record, the facts of each circumstance is very different. And I think that we can say, based off of what has been presented to us thus far, that we have reason to believe that there was practice without a license with Ms. Collins.
Yeah, great. All right. Any further questions or any further discussion? Okay, so all in favor of moving Ms. Collins to the board for with a recommendation of complaint, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, so that motion carries. Now Ms. Hackenall, would you mind summarizing Ms. Collins or Ms. Lemons?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I think the committee members are quite familiar with the facts in this particular case. But again, Ms. Lemons submitted forms to support the application file of Paige Huff, one of which indicated that she provided supervision to Ms. Huff starting on May 16th of 2016. However, she only became licensed in Arizona 30 days subsequent to that, which was June 16th of 2016. And I've identified essentially the same statute 3220.91.12, which may have some bearing on this situation. Additionally, because she is a licensee, she falls under the board's jurisdiction. And so the statute 3220.91 at subsections B, betraying professional confidences, C, making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead, and potentially DD, violating an ethical standard, may come into play with respect to this matter as well.
Thank you. Committee, any discussion on this one?
Mr. Chair, I'm less confident in the information provided of whether or not this individual, I understand that there was a period of time in which supervision hours were unable to count, but I'm not sure that that equates to practicing without a license. For example, I could be supervising an unlicensed BCBA. That BCBA could go out and render a service. And so they're not technically practicing without a license because I'm supervising them, but they wouldn't be able to count their hours to that employee towards certification. So for me, I'm less confident to say we have all of the information. And I would want to maybe have an open-ended discussion of what were the nature of the services between that period of time.
I think to piggyback on that, I forget off the top of my head, how many hours are we talking about in that 30-day period? And Ms. Galvin, I don't know where in the statute and rules, but I believe the psychologists have some provision that an individual can actually practice in the state for some limited period of time prior to licensure, like they can practice 5 days or 15 hours or something like that, correct, before the licensure requirement really kicks in. So if you're just here doing a little triage for, you know, whatever, or, you know, covering for somebody on a medical leave for 3 hours, that there's not the requirement that licensure be in place. And so just wondering if we're kind of going down this path where 30 days and a few hours is not going to amount to an actual violation. I forget what that number is off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Ms. Galvin, to put you on the spot or board staff.
I believe it's 20 days, mm-hmm. But that is someone who lives out of state that may come in through telepractice. I don't see that same exemption for the behavior analyst unless Heidi or Jennifer can point that to me.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, I'm looking at 3220.91.08, exemptions from licensure, subsection A4. A person who resides outside of the state and who is currently licensed or certified as a BA in that state, if the activities and services conducted in the state are within the behavior analyst's customary area of practice, do not exceed 20 days per year.
20 days, okay. But Ms. Lemons, if I remember correctly, she was actually in state, correct? It was the other one that was out of state.
I believe during that time she was residing in Arizona.
Yes, the other thing that comes to me is the application probably was set forth, right? I mean, we're sitting in a 30-day window where it's waiting to be essentially reviewed by this committee and put forward. So the application was probably in, had been sent off for review. And, you know, she's essentially got that 30-day window where she shouldn't be practicing because we haven't approved the application or moved it forward to the board. But, you know, I think to my point is like 30 days is a little different than 1500 hours. So I'm struggling with the severity of that.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, if I may, one, whether or not she was allowed to practice or not, those hours couldn't count towards her supervision. So the applicant had to provide additional documentation to make up those hours, because whether or not she was supervised or fell within that 20 days or whatever, it still doesn't meet the rule for the hours must come from a licensed supervisor. So as far as the applicant status, I think that part's been resolved. My question would be, and this is where I think we would just need more information, but to your point, it might look like 30 days on paper, but if services were only rendered two of those 30 days, then it's not even 30 days. And that's the sort of information that we don't have is, and we only have testimony from a supervisee saying that she was residing here. Maybe she wasn't residing here during that time. So I just feel like we just need to be able to have a conversation with her about that month or those dates. Where was she living? What type of work was she doing? So that we can weed through all of those possibilities.
This is Gina, and I would caution the committee, because it's a very slippery slope to say that, well, 30 days isn't that big of a deal. Well, then is 25 or is 19 or is two, because then you're going to get arguments that your decision is arbitrary and capricious because you can't articulate why 30 isn't a big deal or 15 isn't a big deal, but you know, 21 is. So you have to think about that. And with respect to the exception about someone coming in to the state who doesn't live here and that can't exceed 20 days, and it talks about if that activity is within the behavior analyst custom area of practice. You're talking about you coming in here to practice for 20 days or less, or you coming here to supervise. And we just had a case where you decided that practice doesn't equate to supervision.
Gotcha. That's what we have, Eugene.
Well, and you know, I agree that the words and the way we phrase things absolutely matters, but I also think that it's not the days in this case that make or break whether it's a big deal. I think it's the circumstances surrounding that time period are not full. We don't have all of the full information. And so I think that's what differentiates this case from the other case, is that time period leaves reasonable assumption that there were other things that could have been going on, versus the other one that I don't think leaves that kind of room for debate. And so I completely understand, Ms. Galvin, what you're saying, but I also understand the intent of what I think Dr. Davey was trying to say is more of that the factual basis of what really happened during that period of time is where we don't have the evidence in the same capacity that we do on the other circumstance. So I would feel comfortable tabling this particular item and giving Ms. Lemons the opportunity to come forth to the committee and answer some of our questions before we move forward.
I would second that.
So Dr. Davis Wilson, was that a motion?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So any further discussion? Okay. So motion carries. We'll have Ms. Lemons come in for further discussion, correct?
We will invite her in for further discussion.
We'll invite her in.
And in that invitation, will we also ask for any documentation, like just proactively seek any information she's willing to share that could be reviewed prior? Thank you, Ms. Backenon.
To bring or submit any records that would alleviate the above list of concerns.
Yeah.
Okay. right. Let's move on to agenda number 8, discussion, consideration, possible action of outcome of board review and staff implementation of the RAMP program. Ms. Packer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the committee had requested an update, having made the recommendation to the board to adopt the program. The program, of course, addresses not only a confidential monitoring program for psychologists, but for behavior analysts as well. The board's review was favorable. They approved the implementation of the RAMP program. The board staff has essentially started that process in that we have put this information on our website. However, since we're having this discussion now, I've hesitated to notify the professional associations that this program has been launched, but they will receive a notification later today that they are invited then to share with their members. I've encouraged them to do that. The board staff will also send notification to all licensee psychologists and behavior analysts, because of course not all of those professionals belong to their respective professional association. And we thought that it would be maybe an opportunity if the representative here today, Ms. Elzey, if she would like to offer any comments or any perspective on the RAMP program as it relates to the association and maybe their hopeful plans to help us publicize it. She can also ask any questions while she is here. So I thought we would also invite her to speak to this agenda item if she would like.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I also have Jessica Belokis, who is also a board member of AZYABA, is also present. So happy to get her input too. But yes, anything AZYABA can do to promote, I'm happy to coordinate that via our marketing. And then I'm so sorry. I was going to say I was multitasking a little bit as far as providing commentary. I did not hear. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I just thought that maybe if you had any insights in terms of, you know, the association, you know, any conversations about this program or anything of that nature, if this is all brand new information to AZYABA, that's perfectly fine. We were just hoping that, you know, you have the awareness that the program now exists, and having heard that you are happy to share this information, I think that's something that the committee is, that's well received by the committee.
Yeah, that's the first time I'm hearing about the program. I'm not sure if other AZYABA board members have heard, but this is a new information to me. But again, happy to disseminate any additional information that you'd like me to.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is Jessica just chiming in as well. This is newer information to me as well. So I would love that education, and we would be happy to help disseminate.
Very good. Thank you. The email, I think, is scheduled to go out later today, so I will make sure you are both included on it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation. Ms. Packanon, I am not going to read all those unless I have to, but feel free to summarize.
Very good. And I'm sure you'll be relieved to know that I am not going to summarize all of those bills for you today. I'm actually looking for my notes, and I'm not finding them. Oh, here we go. So I listed lots of bills because at the time that they were, at the time the agenda was prepared, all of these bills had some potential and some capacity to move forward. Really, in the last week or so, several days, really, a number of the bills just simply seem to be going nowhere. They may pick up some velocity, or, you know, that language may appear on a strike everything amendment elsewhere. But I really think that only about 7 of those bills have some direct bearing on regulation specific to behavior analysts. So I'll sort of quickly go through them. House Bill 2067, which has received very strong support from the House of Representatives and has crossed over to the Senate, allows, in the case of a criminal conviction, allows the court to issue an order that includes a certificate of second chance. So unless specified, this releases an individual from all barriers and disabilities in obtaining an occupational license. So this may be something that this committee sees at some point in the future, that an applicant presents with this sort of certificate, and you would have to consider that as removing any possible barriers to licensure. So that is the extent of which I am familiar with that bill, but I can try to answer questions if you have any. Ms. Galvin, have you seen anything of this nature, anything similar?
I have not.
Okay. Yes, this seems to be sort of a new policy idea. I've never seen it before. So moving on to House Bill 2128, this also easily passed through the House and will be soon considered by the Senate. The list of persons that agencies such as this board would be required to waive the initial license fee has been expanded through this bill. So it would include any active duty military service members, the member's spouse, and any veteran. So there will be a fiscal impact to this board. I don't know how many applicants who fit into those categories that present to us, but that's something that we're going to have to modify our applications, you know, and track that certainly more closely than we are should this bill pass. Any questions about that? Okay, the next bill, House Bill 2267. This bill, I'm really, really struggling to envision how it is to be implemented. What it would do is it would essentially compel 90-10 agencies or fee collection agencies such as this board. We have to reduce our fund balance to the level of 50% of the agency's annual appropriation. So our appropriation is about $530,000 annually. So whatever half of that is, $265,000, that is the level that we need to, we cannot let our fund balance to rise above that level, $265,000. Right now, our fund balance is in the neighborhood of $1.2 million. So what this means is that we need to adjust fees on an annual basis in order to shrink the size of the fund. And I believe this means that there will be a substantial period of time where we will essentially be waiving fees in order to keep drawing on the fund, spending the money, and reducing the fund level down. Again, the implementation of this is really a challenge in my mind. I don't have a formula yet for how this is going to work, but I will, of course, be having lots of conversations with lots of other folks to figure out how we achieve this. The objective is to reduce the amount of money that agencies such as ours are sitting on. And I understand that rationale. I don't understand the rationale for the fund balance to be reduced so low that it's only 50% of the annual appropriation. I don't know how that level was arrived at. This bill was introduced last year, almost passed. It will certainly pass this year. It passed the House of Representatives 56-3. So there's a lot of support for this. Any questions about that?
I have lots of comments. We better find things to start spending money on that are going to help us, systems and projects. Because, oh my gosh, I mean, that's years of us essentially having a rainy day fund. My other comment is, can you hurry up? If that's going to happen, can you do it before my fees are due on April 30th?
Dr. Davey, I had the same question. Can we get this in April?
A little personal, but to that point, I don't know how we address it from an equity perspective, because this constant need to adjust fees could, impact licensees differently month to month, year to year. So I'm struggling with it.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yes. So more on that, I'm sure, in the coming months. House Bill 2454. This is the bill that essentially expands telehealth such that it brings most of the delivery of care through telehealth on par to in-person care, prescribes a lot of protections for reimbursement by insurers for services delivered through telehealth. The provision of the bill that I've looked at very closely is the initial bill language allowed for out-of-state licensees to practice into Arizona without having a license. It gave the boards sort of this unclear, in my mind, authority to revoke a privilege that wasn't ever granted to them in the first place. But nonetheless, that language was amended out and replaced with language that essentially establishes a registry for out-of-state licensees to practice via telehealth into Arizona. So that is going to create a requirement on the part of the boards to create the registry. We do have the authority to charge a fee for someone to register to for purposes of practicing into Arizona. So there's a lot of considerations that have to go into that piece of the bill. And we are trying to work with a licensing system that isn't particularly accommodating to making those kinds of changes. So this bill, presents some implementation challenges. What I've noticed about this bill is interesting. It really didn't have that strong of support in passing the House. It was a fairly split vote, 37-22. It's going to be heard by the Senate Finance Committee, and the Finance Committee has not yet scheduled it, and they should have by now. So I do believe that maybe the registered opposition to the bill by some insurance companies may be having a little bit of a chilling effect on this bill moving forward, but I don't know. I've tried to find out more about the status and the future trajectory of this bill, but I haven't heard anything that I feel comfortable that we can rely upon. But obviously watching this one very closely. Thoughts or questions on that bill? Just two more left than Senate Bill 1149. Really what this bill does is it removes some of the unclear language, or I shouldn't say remove, it clarifies some of the unclear language in the Universal Recognition Statute, particularly the Board of Psychology. They had some challenges in interpreting elements of universal recognition law. But what this does is it basically inserts the word shall and takes all of the questions away from whether or not an out-of-state applicant qualifies for licensure by universal recognition. So just with the insertion of that one word, it really solidifies the requirement that we issue a license to someone who applies from another state and establishes residency in Arizona. And then last but not least, the board's bill, Senate Bill 1253, passed the Senate with only one dissenting vote. It will be heard on Monday by the Health and Human Services Committee, and I will be testifying to the bill. The three elements of the bill that impact behavior analysts would be the requirement for fingerprint card clearance, for initial applications and for renewal of applications beginning January 1 of 2022. Also the insertion of language that states that if supervision is provided to an applicant, the supervisor must be licensed in the state where the supervision is provided if licensure is required in that state. And then the last piece is that it clarifies some language in your statute that it ensures that complaints that are of a very serious nature where the public health awareness and health, welfare, and safety is at imminent risk, those complaints can bypass this committee's review and go straight to the board. If you read that language right now, it sort of, it seems to suggest that it must go through committee review and then to the board, but the board wants to have a more expedited process and make sure the language reflects that. So I can answer any questions that you have about that bill.
No questions.
One other update, I am looking every day for the bill to be filed that is, it's called or referred to as the General Appropriations Act. What it does is it designates what every agency, what every budget unit will be appropriated for the coming fiscal year. What we are looking for is the approval by the legislature, as reflected in that bill, that this board can hire another person to help process applications beginning January 1. I built the justification for that request in based on our application trends and some other data, and the governor's office is supporting the addition of that. It would be a half-time FTE, and so assuming the bill reflects that, then we could be expanding our staff and in the process, I think, delivering more prompt services to the behavior analyst community. Questions of anything of a legislative nature? Okay.
All right, let's move on. Agenda item 10, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding licensure and regulatory issues relative to COVID-19. Ms. Sacramento?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So just some foreshadowing for you. I don't have anything to discuss today, but on your next agenda, I will be bringing an executive order issued by the governor a couple of weeks ago. There's an element in this executive order that requires that all state agencies shall conduct a comprehensive review of any rules that were suspended during the public health state of emergency for COVID-19 to determine if those rules should be permanently suspended. And we shall send a report to that effect to the governor's office by June 1. So I think what that would look like, Ms. Galvin, is that this committee would look at its own rules and make recommendations to the board, and then the board would evaluate and approve those along with their own. And as a collective, that would be forwarded to the governor's office. Is that correct?
Agreed, yes.
Okay, very good. And that is my only update.
Stand off, we can't hear you. I'm sure you're making great statements though.
Okay. Agenda item number 12, discussion consider, or excuse me, 11. Wait, where are we at here? 11. Let's see here. Yeah, discussion, consideration, possible action on proposed application edits to address COVID-19 education training modification. Ms. Polk.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, the ASPPB had notified the board, all licensing boards, that they had a list of questions that we may wish to add to our applications regarding COVID-19 changes. So the application review committee reviewed those and they elected just one of the questions to be very broad, to be added to the verifications. And it basically just asks, are there any changes that were made due to COVID or due to the state of emergency? And so board staff thought it might be something that the Committee on Behavior Analysts would want to look at and see if they wanted to add a similar language to the verification form in their application. And so we've put that language in, it's highlighted in the posted application for you to consider. And that's all That's it. Dr. Stenhoff, you're muted.
Stenhoff is just...
Yeah, so does everybody have the document to review? Or has everybody had a chance to review the document? Any comments on that? Okay. All right, let's move on. Agenda item number 12, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Packenheim.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The BACB supplied a report, compilation of all of the regulators' listserv communications from the previous year. At some point, in 2020, I supplied most of that information to this committee when it, you know, truly was, you know, impacted the committee or of interest to the committee. If it was sort of an administrative topic or issue, I didn't necessarily forward all of those communications to you. So a lot of that information is probably, you've already read it, but I think it's nicely compiled and it's a good resource in my mind if we ever needed to sort of go back and do a little bit of research. So that is one piece of information that the BACB shared. The other piece, of course, was just some commentary, I guess a cautionary tale of sorts, relative to how jurisdictions might want to consider the definition of client. And I found that to be a very timely piece of communication, given that this committee is, you know, doing taking a close look at that particular definition in the context of lots of other policy issues that you're considering. So that information, you know, you may want to consider it or think about it as it comes on the next, the agenda of the next special meeting and in future meetings.
All right, thank you. Okay, so agenda item number 13, new agenda items for future meetings. I know we noted a few of those. Could we list those again? And somebody
take a note? Mr. Chair, my notes reflect that we're going to invite two individuals to meet with the committee for purposes of the committee gathering more information about the circumstances surrounding their reported supervision as provided to Ms. Huff and the executive order that compels this committee to take a look at its administrative rules in light of which ones were suspended or waived for, you know, for the duration of the pandemic.
Did we also have a discussion about inviting a member of ASU's online program?
Yes, thank you. Well,
yeah, I would like to have a discussion around the ASU program and inviting their whoever they would like. Sounds like Dr. Which there's two of them, but at ASU, by the way, because there's Dr. Sam Diganji and then Dr. Amanda Diganji. So when I say Dr. Diganji, I think either could come or both. But I think having that conversation would be important. One other agenda item, and I know I mentioned it the last meeting, because the BACB updates included the report of, it was like their statistics of who's all certified and the demand needs of the field. And coincidentally, after that meeting, I had a former supervisee of mine let me know that she was applying for a job outside of the field. And I was like, oh, why are you, you know, leaving the field? And she said, because nobody will hire me as a BCABA because I can't be licensed. And so I know I mentioned it before, and I think that this is, it's interesting that I now have an actual, you know, physical person from somebody saying like, me as a BCABA is of no value to anybody. And so I think one of the topics that I proposed we address at some point, whether it's now or in our conversations with the professional association, is education around what a BCABA can still do within the license, because there's no reason why there should be this blanket understanding of a BCABA cannot practice in Arizona because they're not eligible for licensure. Because that's not true. It's true that they're not eligible for licensure, yes, but it's not true that they wouldn't be able to practice. So I don't know if that's something through a substantive policy or something, if there's clarification we can provide somewhere in that, or if it's just a matter of opening up the discussion and really hoping that the professional association hears kind of the information we're getting from the BACB as far as market need, the information we know we have from the access the access administration around not having enough service providers to serve the population. And then this information of again, I don't understand the interpretation of how a BCABA is not allowed to practice. Again, unless they're interpreting that independent practice as being the end all be all, because they're not allowed to independently practice. But I just want to open up the conversation and if all that comes of it is the professional association here gets to hear some of the commentary and can use it as education to the members, that'd be great. But I knew it was out there, but I was a little disheartened to know that that was the direction she was taking because of the difficulty in seeking employment.
Very good. And Mr. Chair, if I may, Jennifer corrected me. I misspoke as it relates to how you want the supervisors to come back to you. I recall now that in the case of Ms. Collins, there's a complaint being opened. So you're only inviting Ms. Lemons to come back. So I'm sorry for that, for my misspeak. And then in terms of agenda item number 11, I think we need maybe some clarification on that one too, because Kathy messaged me asking if the committee had maybe reached a consensus about that application edit, or if you don't want to us to implement the edit. So maybe we should get some directions so we're not confused on what you want us to do.
Okay. So committee, were you all happy with, I believe it was item number 12? On the application, so on page 9 of the PDF.
And Mr. Chair, committee members, we what we're suggesting is just, you know, to frame the question pretty broadly, pretty generally, just to sort of we don't want to be super prescriptive about, you know, how we answer questions, how we ask questions and what questions we ask. What we found from ASPPB is they had, you know, painstakingly identified so many questions that an applicant could potentially answer, and really the board and staff feel that just sort of throwing it open for, you know, whatever response may be supplied, but that was the better approach.
So is it my understanding that an affirmative on 12 would then prompt the individual to provide the written explanation, just as if, like, if there was a discussion around whether or not they had been gotten a misdemeanor or, you know, something to that effect? So I think my only comment was that, similar to how we put, if you're going to provide a written explanation, I forget where we put this in the change, that you should be prepared to, you know, you probably want to be on the call when we talk. So if we have further questions, we can ask it right there on the spot versus having to go to further requests for information. My only other concern is an applicant's understanding of what that modification might be. And if that is, well, I ended up doing, you know, a bulk of my supervision was all provided via Zoom versus face-to-face or whatever that might be. How do we know that each applicant is is seeing the quote unquote modification in a similar fashion. And I get it. You know, like you said, there's probably so many different modifications that could be made. We'd be putting 75 different, you know, options on the table. Doesn't seem viable, but do we need to have some like at least some parenthetical examples that we're interested in capturing? At least give us a fighting chance of like what the big three are that we might be interested in. Otherwise, I think we're not going to have uniform responding from the applicants. And then if that's the case, then why do we even have the question?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davey, this is Kathy. The this question number 12 is on the verification. So it's not being asked of the applicant, only the verifier, the supervisor. Okay.
So, but again, my same comments just flipped to the supervisor. What are the big three that we would think the modifications are that we would want explained in a written way, or are we just going to leave this for interpretation of the supervisor to decide how to explain those modifications? Are there things, and I asked this to the committee. Are there things that we would be concerned about if there was a modification made that would raise a red flag? Or are we just simply getting this information so that the board can, or so that the committee can comply with the request from the state?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, if I may, there are some standard like allowances that the BACB has set forth, like the not, you know, maybe not having face-to-face contact with the client or what have you. My concern would be for individuals that maybe did supervision in other states where there may have been additional modifications set forth by executive orders of those other states that could potentially be either problematic for us where we say, nope, we have a statute and we didn't address this in our COVID exemptions. So we're kind of just stuck. So let's say, for example, and I highly doubt that this is the case, but let's say, for example, a state said, you know, we don't want anybody conducting in-person FBAs. And so now this supervisee has had experience of not, you know, or their experience may be just mock FBAs and not anything else or what have you. And so they answer no to the question, or they say, yeah, this person has, we walked through FBAs, so I'm going to answer yes, but we didn't actually conduct an FBA because there were no clients available during the time that I supervised them to conduct the FBA. We wouldn't be able to make a decision on that now. We could have our thoughts about it, but it wouldn't be until they provide that justification as to why they address supervision the way that they would, that we would then be able to look at it and be like, does this fall within one, clinical appropriateness to where we feel like, hey, this person is good to be licensed and possibly conducting FBAs. Maybe the answer is we can license them with this order of, what is it, like probation or additional supervision or what have you. And that's probably a really kind of ludicrous example, but I think if we sat and we started looking at all of the possibilities across different states and across different things, I don't know that we would be able to pin it, but I think that a supervisor over the applicant themselves, a supervisor should know the standards of supervision fluently enough to know if they had to make a COVID modification. You know, and I run a supervision practice. All we do is supervision. We have 14 supervisees. We have no other lines of business. Like that is the services that we do. Right. And so I could tell you what modifications have had to be made in light of COVID. Now we're in Arizona, so obviously we've only made modifications that align with both the psychology board guidance, that document that they have on the website, and also the BACB guidance and what have you. But what if these services were in California, where there might be different health department rules? And this is where it's a little bit unique, is generally speaking, those differences in those health department rules, we would say, well, our state is what trumps. But it could be that the way that they articulate it kind of could fall in one of the other exemptions that we have. So I feel like the possibilities here are endless. And I think that especially with behavior analysts, when we write, I think we have a habit of kind of prescribing things out, right? Like here are the types of things you might want to think about. But then it limits to just that. And then they'll say, oh, well, I didn't include these other things because you didn't list them there, or those weren't included. And so it's this interesting, like, do we leave it open-ended? Do we add some, like, short list with the option to continue out the list? Like, I get...
I just think at a minimum, we're going to have to give Kathy some guidance. So if I'm a supervisor and I've made a couple modifications and I call Kathy and say, hey, this modification was changed. You know, this was a mod. Is this something you want me to reflect there? Like, Kathy's going to be able to be conversant with those individuals. And, you know, at what level is that modification required to be captured there? Because if I'm the supervisor reading that, I've done what I need to do in Arizona, and I'm thinking about responding to this, I'm going to call the board and ask them, you know, do I need to list these things out? Is this what you're looking for? And Kathy's going to need to be able to be advised by us. So maybe it's an internal document that, you know, Diana, that we need to work on about, just particularly about what things have been done in Arizona to give Kathy a fighting chance to talk to somebody in Texas. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I think that need may come up, and I think it's a great suggestion. I think it could also be that it's not needed, because it could be that it's so clearly articulated on the document they already have that it's a no-brainer. And then the other thing that I worry about is giving too much authority, no offense to Ms. Folks, she's amazing, but giving too much authority and interpretation of something that should be the role of the board to interpret. And the reason why I bring that up, we had that come up today, right? Where seemingly it appears that we can tell someone, hey, yeah, you can just submit other hours, but now we're in a situation where maybe they were under the impression that they could submit these other hours, as Ms. Folks said, and Ms. Folks wasn't wrong, right? Because the assumption would be that those other hours would still fall under the statutory requirements. Mm-hmm. But now we're going to have this person that may sit before us and say, wait, I was told I could submit these hours and that's what I did. And now you're saying I can't, when mm-hmm. I think that some of those things probably should be addressed at the board, at the committee level to begin with, so that there isn't that interpretation. You know, I had a former supervisee of mine reach out to me not too long ago and be like, they had asked, they said, so my employer said they contacted the board and the board had all these responses for them on how to do something. And I was like, well, I said, you might want to contact the board yourself, because I don't know that the board has the authority to make, like, that's not the role of the board to make.
But I think, my point would be if Kathy could say, if you were in Arizona, here are three examples. Like, I'm just saying, like, she's got to have a fighting chance. I'm not saying it can be the end all be all, but Kathy's got to be able to converse in the, like, you know, if the person's asking questions, she's like, I can't give you all the advice, but if you were here in Arizona, there's a potential ones you would want listed, something to that effect. And again, I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill. I'm just, you know, we already have questions around how this application gets filled out. I just think that these kind of broad stroke questions lead us into ununiform responses from the supervisors. And it's just, you know, I wouldn't put it past me that Kathy would get a couple phone calls, and I just want to give her as much information as we possibly can, even if it's just one concrete example of something we experienced in Arizona.
Mr. Chair, committee members, if I may, I just want to go back to something Dr. Davis-Wilson said. When I have told people that they can submit additional hours that are not from their certification, I do tell them they have to meet the requirements in our statutes and rules. And I point out where to find them and I send them to them, so that is always the case. And with what you're saying, Dr. Davey, I would love guidance. Given what you said at this point, what I would say to someone who was asking, I would say that the board has made these waivers. And I'd point out what the waivers were in Arizona. And that's about as far as I would go. And because I know that would not be my decision, that would be yours. And so I would tell them, if you made a modification, submit it, whatever it is, and let the committee decide. I try not to do any interpretation. That would be way beyond my pay grade.
And And perhaps, Ms. Folks, it's just a matter of looking at that document that you guys have already created and posted on all those waivers to make sure there isn't anything, because I think that would be the extent of the tool that you would kind of need, is that document, I would imagine. I'm all for creating additional supports. I just don't know how much of this is going to come up and in what direction it's going to go to be able to proactively create those supports. I think it would take having a couple of examples to be like, oh, this is taking a lot of my, like, we would rely on you, Ms. Folks, to say, like, this is taking a lot of my time and I don't really know how to respond. But I think that there's those endless possibilities. And I think it really comes down to, there's already a document already posted that may address those things. And I'm like you, like, answer yes and fill it out. Like, I think sharing that information would allow for us to make those decisions. But I think having a tool, I like said in the first place, I like the idea of having a tool if the tool is necessary. I wouldn't know where to proactively go with it until we see some of these questions come up.
So I guess the real question that came from Heidi was, are we okay with that question as it is? And I think, you know, the short answer is yes. The long answer is no, because it's just ambiguous. And I can't imagine that the psychology board is not going to feel the same when they have the discussion. So maybe this is a to be continued as we kind of get some responses and we can look at them and maybe make some aids, some, you know, essentially job aids for Kathy, and see what kind of responses we get from the psychology side as well.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the one thing that one of the things I got out of your discussion is that perhaps you would like to see part of the question to say why they made the change, such as an executive order from a different state and so on. Is that something you would want added to that question?
So it's like, here's the change and why. So kind of a cause and effect, almost, like, here's, you know, executive order in Texas XXX required us to do A, B, and C.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. So maybe just adding in there, if so, please provide a written explanation detailing the changes and their rationale, like, because I think it's still that written explanation of, like, here's the changes I made, and I made it because of these reasons, whether it's an executive order, whether it's a limitation of their job, whether it's because they all had to close down for 2 months. But just provide rationale, or, like, provide written rationale and explanation detailing the changes.
Yes.
Supporting documentation.
I mean, the semi good part of this for behavior analysts is really the BACB's only made that single accommodation so far of, you don't have to be face to face with, you know, the student. So again, the supervisor should still be aiming to meet all the other requirements, or certification is going to be a problem too. So that's the good news, is that I agree with you, Brian. This could be very, very ambiguous and could lead us down a bunch of rabbit holes. But hopefully, because we're asking the supervisor, not the supervisee, hopefully the supervisor is a little bit more familiar with what the BACB and the state laws are saying.
Sounds good.
So, Ms. Folks, you would make some of those changes that we've noted, and then we can take a look at it at the next meeting, perhaps?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. So, and then that also could be added to agenda item number 13, which we discussed earlier.
I have a question. And it actually just popped up. So we're asking the supervisor of this, and it goes back to Dr. Davies' point earlier. We're asking the supervisor this, but what happens when they turn in the BACB form? Should we also consider asking the supervisee at some point in the application, or do we just say like, oh, well, you turned in this form, so you get less questions than this form? Hmm. Do you know what I, and this came up earlier. Yeah. Dr. Davey had brought it up earlier too, in a different circumstance, but it's the same, to me, it's kind of the same issue, right? Like someone could turn in the BACB form and they would never be asked this question.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this may be a question for Jean, but is there in that 404.2, is there, or maybe it's 403, I think, that asks about verifications. Does it give the option? I believe it gives the option for the committee to ask additional, for additional information, but I'm not sure.
I think we have the authority to request additional information, but I think it would be the order in which we request it. If it's not on the application, then do we just say like, oh, well, this applicant, like, do we go, which is what we were trying to avoid doing here, right? Going applicant by applicant and being like, well, your supervision was during COVID, so we're going to now delay your application to get more information. Or do, or can we use that rule then to add this language into another part of the application?
Thank you. That actually is my question. You said it much better.
Hope you're on mute.
You're asking an additional question here, or proposing to ask an additional question. And the rules are very specific about what you can ask on the application. So we don't want to ask a question that will serve as a possible basis for denial if we don't have the authority to ask that question. And I know that COVID has presented all sorts of exceptions and everything, but if this is an attempt just to gather more information, this is something that, you know, the national board is seeking, or ASPBB, we have to look at really the purpose. Are we asking it just to gather more data, or is it going to be something that we could deny the license, a basis for license denial? And Dr. so that's, go ahead.
This is my concern, is we're now a year into COVID, meaning that we theoretically could have a supervisee who does an entire 1500 hours without ever setting foot in front of a client. And that to me would be very concerning. So technically they could do their entire supervision and it count by the BACB, which it's concerning. It, and let me preface this by the fact that I don't think anybody expected this to be kind of the new normal. And so I think there's going to have to be, and they may already be having discussions around this, or maybe in response to some of their regulatory updates, we can say, hey, where are we at with this? Cause we're pushing a year now. And if client contact isn't required, then we theoretically could have somebody certified and potentially licensed who has never been hands-on with a child or an individual receiving services. And that to me is concerning. And I think that it would weigh in decision of whether or not we approve a license. Not necessarily just deny a license. It could be that we do similar to what we have to do when someone does supervision outside of licensure and maybe offer a withdrawal or more time. But I am concerned that we are going to have a batch of people who through this time has never had to provide services in person or face-to-face or even telehealth type services with a live actual client.
And that's a little bit of a different issue than the question that you're being asked to look at, is to explain how your experience was altered, you know, during COVID. You're focusing on some of those answers that were going to be provided could very well be the basis for a possible denial or at least some concern on part of the committee. So I don't want to get too far off of the agenda item. And I think what you're suggesting does merit a bigger discussion. And it sounds like we have some more work to do as far as tweaking the question that, you know, you've been asked to look at today, kind of two separate issues.
So, and I agree with that. So perhaps maybe a future agenda item where we tackle the issue of the extenuating timeframe of some of these waivers and the effects that they have, with then making a decision on how we craft the language and just kind of table this part.
Just because of it, I don't think it's on the agenda in an appropriate and it's full disclosure type of way.
I would be totally fine with that.
Okay, so just to summarize, we'll table that that application item at this point, and then we'll have further discussion about it in the future. Okay.
Yeah, I think Kathy's going to work on maybe bringing back the question with a little bit more clarity based on the discussion, and then a broader discussion about some of these deviations from the typical education and experience. What are we going to do when those deviations come before the board? Is that person qualified to get a license?
Okay. All right. Any other possible future agenda items?
I have one, and it's in light to a recommendation that we made as part of a disciplinary action. But, you know, the psychology board has a list of like professionals that they can use for like practice monitors and what have you. So, but we don't, and we don't really have resources for professionals to access some of that stuff. Is that something we could add to the agenda of, you know, in the future? How, like, I don't know the history of how the psychology board developed that list or where it came from, or, you know, but I think that maybe understanding the history of that, you know, their list of professionals and kind of what we can do from there.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. And I wanted to step back, and this is regarding the ASU online. I just wanted to offer one more name. It's been a name that I've been referred to about the program, but it's Anna, and I believe it's A-N-A, Ruiz. At least for instructors, that's been the contact name that I've been given over the last couple of months. So, okay. All right, any other possible agenda items? All right, let's move on to item 14, adjournment. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
All right.
Oh, second.
Second, all right. Discussion, let's get out of here. Okay. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.